with changes in your local daylight savings time. If it did, it wouldn't be a global standard. See, now one of the little mysteries about UTC is why it is called UTC, as I mentioned earlier. Why not CUT? You know, since it's coordinated universal time. So it turns out the International Telecommunications Union felt it was best to designate a single abbreviation for use in all languages. But no one could agree on using either the English word or order, or which is CUT, or the French word order, TUC. So they couldn't decide between English and French. So they compromised, and we ended up with UTC. And that's interesting because I didn't even know that. You know, you think of UTC as Coordinated Universal Time, but they have it as UTC. And that, for that reason alone, because of the universal thing, they cleared that up. Okay, any questions up to that point?
T2NKL.
Yes, go ahead. I didn't get the call, but go ahead.
It's KC2NKL, Bernard. I just joined. I was just turned on the radio a second ago and I was listening to what you were saying. So the question I have for you is, instead of one person converting to whatever time zone the other person has mentioned, now if two people converting to UTC or to Zulu time, so I guess it makes it more fair.
Yeah, well, the person that you're talking to on the bands, whatever mode you're using, and with these digital modes with the internet, you could talk all over the world. So again, it comes into play. It's not only HF, but it could be on 2 meters also, or UHF or whatever you're doing. So yes. So again, it's a way of avoiding the confusion as far as time. All right, so continuing. Now, this is the question that Howard brought up just before. So here's the difference between UTC, GMT, and UT1. There is a common misconception that UTC and GMT, which is Greenwich Mean Time, are the same. Not quite. The difference involves how time is measured. GMT is a 24-hour astronomical time system based on the local time at Greenwich, England. And as you said, Howard, it's on the 0-degree meridian of longitude. GMT can be considered equivalent to UTC only when fractions of a second are not important. So there you go. There's your differences right there. Occasional leap seconds are introduced into the UTC time system by international agreement for keeping the atomic-based time scale in approximate agreement with the astronomical time scale, which is UTI. So the UTI is the astronomical time scale, which is based on the rotation of the Earth. Even though the atomic UTC time scale is much more uniform than the UTI scale, some users must work with Earth-based time. And to give you an example, for example, boaters, which makes sense, using celestial navigation need to know the UTI time of their observations. Since only UTC time is normally broadcast by time and frequency radio stations such as WWV, as we both of us know, the broadcasters agree to occasionally adjust UTC time in steps of exactly 1 second, so the difference between UTC and UTI would never exceed 0.9 tenths of a second. Celestial navigators would then use the received UTC signal and know that any errors...
Repeater, timeout.
This is NY2H. You got a guy in Queens hanging the system up. There's a guy in Central Queens jamming right now.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, Lou, I'm monitoring. I stopped as soon as I heard repeated timeout, so nobody missed anything. But I'll respect the timeout. What do you have it set for, just so I know?
Yeah, it's about 3 minutes, and it should only be like a 5 second penalty. But this guy in Central Queens was keying up and holding it.
Okay, I'll look into that. Okay, all right, thanks.
NY2H.
Let me continue. Let me just step back here. So as I just to repeat, I was talking about the difference between UTC and UTR, UT1. This looks like an I. UT1. So I said celestial navigators would then use the received UTC signals to know that any errors with respect to UT1 would be less than a second. So it's good for boaters, you know, and that's what they basically have, you know, the reason why they do that. So that concludes that paragraph. I just have a few more left. At this point, regarding, Howard, I'm sure you're still listening, the difference now between UTC, GMT, and UT1, you got that answer, is that right? All right, I guess that was left. Okay, so the next paragraph is what time and date is it? So we'll continue here. UTC is set up using a 24-hour clock system. So it only operates on as a 24-hour clock system. Midnight is 0000 UTC. You might see this written as 0000 Zulu. I call it Zulu. Remember, at 40 UTC, a new calendar day begins. Your local time might be February 20th, but when your UTC clock switches from 2359 Zulu to 0000 Zulu, your UTC date is now February 21st. It is important to keep this in mind when logging contacts and filling out QSO cards. So there you go. You know, for the amateurs that are using this, that's important. So there's a local time versus UTC time, and depending on where you are in the United States, we are in the Western Hemisphere. So we have hours behind UTC. We're always going hours behind UTC. And depending on whether you're Atlantic time, Eastern time, Central, Mountain, Pacific, Alaska, or Hawaii time, that'll determine how many hours behind UTC. So, continuing, even though UTC is a worldwide standard, most of us conduct our daily lives according to our own local time, which is known as LT, which is local time. The UTC clock in your shack is handy, but when planning your operating events, you still have to convert to LT, which is local time. Now, what about that contest that starts tomorrow at 1700 UTC? If you live in the Eastern time zone, which is where we live, that in the United States, and daylight savings time is not in effect, because that'll change it by 1 hour. The contest actually begins at high noon, your local time, which happens to be a 5 hour difference between you, a 5 hour lag, a 5 hour behind, or lag, I'm going to say, behind UTC. So, 17 minus 5 is 12.
Repeater, timeout.
timed out. He's keyed up. He'll be on.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
I got it. Stand by. Okay. I just want to look up something over here. All right. Sorry for the timeouts because I'm reading something here and I'm not paying attention to the time, the 3 minute timeout here. So I have to. I got to keep that in mind. All right. So as I was just explaining, the difference between 1700 UTC and your local time is a 5 hour difference. Atlantic time is a 4 hour difference. Eastern is 5. Central is 6. Manhattan is 7. And the Pacific is 8. And you know, there's a chart which actually shows that. What I just know for this area is there's a 5 hour difference for Eastern time, which is where we're in. And right now we're in daylight savings time. So because instead of it being 5 hours, because we're on daylight savings time, it's actually 4 hours. It's one hour difference. So we're 4 hours behind UTC in daylight savings. But that's a standard which now, I know. And we can keep in mind that if you're staying in this area, in the eastern time zone, that'll stay the same, except for, again, being... daylight savings or non-daylight savings time. So, almost done here. Converting between UTC and local time is not very difficult. Just remember that everything is referenced back to UTC. You simply have to determine how many hours, which is an X number, your local time is offset, ahead, or behind UTC. Hams in the United States and Canada can use this table, the one I just mentioned, to determine their offset values. Hams in the Western Hemisphere reside west of 0 degree longitude. To convert between UTC and local time, they can use a simple formula, which is UTC equals local time plus X, which is the time, the hours behind UTC, or converting the transposing the equation local time equals UTC minus X. And there you go. There's the way to figure out your local time as based on UTC time. So local time is equal to UTC minus the X, which is the number depending on where you're located. Much of the rest of the world lies east of 0 degree longitude. And hams in these areas can use, it's just the opposite, it's UTC equals local time minus X instead of plus X, or...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a way we could disable the timer for the net. All right. Anyway, we wait to CDL. Continuing. I'm almost done here. Don't want to destroy too many ears listening to this. So just to finish up here, I just gave the formulas regarding UTC, depending on where you're located. So. Let's assume that you're spending the winter in Minnesota. No, I'm sorry, not Minnesota. It's Missoula, Montana. That's where you are. It looks like Minnesota, but Missoula, Montana, if I'm pronouncing it right. And you want to join a net at 2200 UTC. What is that in local time? So by looking at the table for that, for mountain time zone, you see that your local time is 7 hours behind UTC. And just plug in the numbers and run the formula. Local time equals UTC minus 7. Local time is equals 2200, because that's UTC time minus 7, which is 1500 hours. Again, it's in 24 hour time, so 1500 hours will be 3 o'clock. Right? 13 is 1 o'clock, 14 is 2 o'clock, 15 is 3 o'clock, and so on up to 24. So that's how that works. Okay, so to summarize, without UTC, we would be setting appointments and making schedules based on patchwork of old time zones and change with sessions and geography. Let me let it drop.
So after the 23rd hour in military?
Wait, what was that again?
We would just recommend a force reboot to get it to release. After the 23rd hour in military, as if it were the 11th hour, wouldn't it go back to zero, or would it be considered 24-something?
It goes back to zero. It's in 24-hour time. So you got 23:59, and then you got 24, 23:59, 24, then you got zero. It goes back to zero after that.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah, I was right. It was zero. I thought it went to 24-something, and then just back down. But, yeah, I was right. It's, it goes back to zero.
Okay. All right, very good, Greg. Thanks. Let me just finish up here. So, again, the last thing, the benefit of using UTC for worldwide communication speaks for itself. It keeps the amateur's life simple and sane. Okay. All right, so that's it. So everyone has a little bit of understanding what UTC is now. So if you want to get a sked set up, you use that as your clock. If you don't have it already on your wristwatch, you could buy one. That'll give you UTC time. And go from there. So that's it. Thank you, Roy. This will be Andy's Corner. And from time to time, I'll have little bits of segments of information. There's a lot of information in QST and in the handbook. And some things are technical, some things not so technical. But I think it would be an interesting subject to add to the TechNet. Because there's an awful lot of information out there, and we hams are always looking for information, and it's a lifetime of learning. It never ends, as you know. So Roy, back to you. Thank you for letting me have this little segment, and we'll continue next time. AC2GS, W8 to CDO.
WS2N. Quick question, Andy.
Oh, how you doing, Paul? Go.
Yeah, as far as the UTC goes, in my old Technician General ARRL book, they had UTC and they had Universal Temps Coordonnées. It was French for the same thing, you know, UTC, for Coordinated Universal Time. So that's why they came up with the UTC, Universal Temps Coordonnées. My question really is, why did they use the French... The article that you read, did they say why they used the French instead of the English? I mean, originally it was going through Greenwich for England. How come they switched over to France? One of it says, back to you, Andy.
Well, according to this article, no one could really agree on using either the English word, you know, which would be CUT, Coordinated Universal Time, or the French word, which would be TUC. So I guess simply because nobody could agree, because it's a universal thing, so they compromised and they came up with UTC. Just for that reason, and that's what it says. Other than that, I have to do further reading and further exploring to understand why, but basically this is what they came up with. And this is the International Telecommunications Union that came up with this idea. Back to you.
Very good. Yeah, thanks for that. You know, it's probably some kind of deal they must have made in years ago. But thanks for that. WS2N.
K2RY.
Okay. All right, let me give it back to Roy. Roy, I can sort out who's checking in late and go from there. Roy, again, thank you, and back to you, Roy. AC2GS, W2CDL.
This is AC2GS, and thank you very much, Andy. I really appreciate your time and your effort in Andy's Corner, and I look forward to many, many more episodes. David, I'm not quite sure if you wanted to ask Andy a question or what, but I heard you throw your call sign out.
Thank you, Roy. Andy, I have an app on my Mac for UTC, and on one side it's UTC and the other side is it's local time, and I was able to download it for free, and I use it when I log my HF contacts.
Okay, I'll just acknowledge that. Yeah, I'm sure, you know, with with this computer age that we live, you know, as I mentioned, you know, there are wristwatches which, that do it, there are computers that do it, there are apps that do it, there are phones that do it, and you could, you know, you could get all these standards right at your fingertips. So if you need it, it's right there. So I understand that. Okay. All right, I'm glad you have the app. And if you use it, fine. I'm sure you do if you're making contacts overseas in different parts of the world. So, again, to avoid all the confusion. Okay, at this point, I'm going to sign, because I got other things to do. So, 73 guys, and thanks again. I'm going to give it back to Roy, W8CDO. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thanks again, Andy. As far as time is a kind of interesting thing to me, personally. You know, people used to have just local time. They used to have sundials and water clocks and such going back to Babylon and Mesopotamia and Egypt and such. And it was only with the industrial and the mechanical revolution when railroads were placed down and different areas were connected by routes and you had to coordinate schedules. That's when they first figured out that they couldn't just have local time. So that was kind of the beginning of the GMT type of time. And different areas chose their different offsets. We're used to one-hour offsets here in the United States, but in Europe and parts of Asia, they have half-hour or 45-minute segments that are offset from GMT. In 1961, they decided that GMT wasn't good enough for them. They needed to have something more accurate, so they brought on UTC. UTC, though, implements leap seconds, which caused people to be annoyed to the point where they're actually talking up a new time standard that they've kind of pushed onto the schedule someplace around 2023. They're going to talk about a new replacement for UTC. So that's my 2 cents worth about time. Any other questions about time, please feel free.
W-A-2-D-H,
about the atomic clock.
Okay, unfortunately, two people doubled. I made out David's question. It was something about the atomic clock. Yeah, the thing is that we now have such accuracy with timekeeping that we can keep the time intervals right, but they veer off from the astronomical time because the Earth isn't the perfect system and it doesn't work the same way that the atomic clocks work. So you have to reorder time every so often and correct it, and that's where the leap seconds come in.
QSL. But would it be significant if they dismantled the atomic clock now?
Well, if we didn't have it, we wouldn't know what we were missing, I guess, in a way. But it's too late to disassemble an atomic clock because at this point there are probably tens of thousands of very, very precise atomic clocks scattered all over the world, not to mention on all the satellites. So, you know, the horse is out of the barn.
QSL, thank you, Roy. Could you put me on the list for questions?
Yeah, I certainly can. Consider yourself on the list. There was another person. I didn't quite get their call sign. It might have been Ed, but I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah, this is WA2VDH with a related question. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, John. Yeah, what's your question related to that?
My question is it possible to, from UTC, to convert to sidereal time? Maybe this is more a question for Paul, but so you could, you know, measure like for the right ascension. If you're given the right ascension of a celestial object, you'll know when it's on your meridian. If you know the sidereal, your local sidereal time. Go ahead.
Okay, John, that's a good question. My surmise would be that there are conversion mathematical formulas to do between one or the other. As you suggested, I will ask Paul if he knows anything on this subject.
What are you talking about, sidereal time? I kind of missed that. Back to you, Roy.
Is it possible a conversion from UTC to sidereal time? Go ahead.
Well, that's always drifting. I think that would be that would change over time. I don't know of what mathematical conversion they would use for that, but I would imagine that would change from. Probably from day to day, or from moment to moment, because the sidereal time tends to change as the Earth goes around the Sun. So, you know, just looking at the same spot in the sky, and then, you know, 6 months later, or three, you know, a couple months later, it's looking at another spot in the sky. So I don't know how you would come up with a formula to you know, once you found the local time, you know, then you go back to Andy's formula, but that you have to change sidereal time to, right, you know, local time first, I would think. Back to you.
Yeah, I know I've seen sidereal clocks. I know they run on a different time base. It's not a true 24-hour system. I think it's like 23 hours and 57 minutes or something. So I guess that there wouldn't be a straight a conversion between them. The sidereal clocks I've seen advertised, I could say they have a different time base than regular ones. I was just wondering if there was some kind of conversion. But, okay, thanks. Appreciate it.
ATQLR.
Yes, Kay.
A sidereal clock is designed to complete 24 hours of sidereal time in 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds of solar time. So if that makes sense, for every 23 hours of our regular UTC time, it's been 24 hours of sidereal time. I think it's that simple. I think you just make it like a fraction, you know what I mean? Like 23.56.04 over 24. You know, I'm terrible at that. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I think that utilizes an averaging across the entire orbit of the Earth around the Sun. Because since it's not a perfect sphere, it's an elliptical orbit, there's probably some variation at different times. There actually is apparently a formula to do the conversion. It has a lot of factors in it. It has squares and cubes of constants and a series of other plug-in constants. So it's not a simple kind of a Fahrenheit to Celsius type of transformation. But I believe that, you know, within a certain error amount, you can do the conversion from sidereal to UTC time. You could also take the average number, and people won't quibble too much with you.
Oh yeah, fine business. I can see why running on a different time base it would be a lot more complicated. As Kay mentioned, that it would it's not a true 24-hour clock. Okay, I really appreciate it. Oh, I'll say good evening to Kay there also.
Okay, very good. Thank you, John. Thank you, Kay. David, you have a question for us tonight.
Well, I have one more question about time, and then I'll ask my other question. My question about time, the time in New Delhi, India, is 9.5 hours ahead of New York. How do they set that up?
Well, as I mentioned before, we're kind of making assumptions here in the United States because we look at most of the time zones and their integer, they're the next integer over. So, you know, going central time is 1 hour, Pacific time is another hour. So you're kind of used to that 1 hour increment. But there are countries all over the world that arbitrarily decide on different offsets from UTC. There's no law that says that your local time zone has to be an integer. It can be a fractional value.
Thank you very much. Now I'm going to ask my other question. Could you talk about the history of Field Day? And can you talk a little bit about the rules for Field Day? Specifically, you know, for COVID-19 Field Day.
Okay, there was someone out there who threw out their call sign in case they had some comment to make about time.
Yeah, KD2NBP with a comment about time.
Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, there's a little book in my family that my paternal grandfather wrote about his... my life when I was young. It's a nice little book he wrote. He's an English literature professor, by the way. And it was just published for the family. No one else has it. It's a little book. And he talked about his childhood. And one thing he mentioned was, like, the trains. He grew up in, like, Saginaw, Michigan. And he talked about, he was born in 1896. So we're talking about probably around 1910. And I think the time zones got standardized around the time of World War One. I don't know exactly when. But so this was just before that. And there were like, there'd be this town, and he said this, the town 10, 20 miles away, what might be a half an hour different time zone than where he was. And the train schedules were incredibly complicated to parse. He talks about this. So I don't know if you know anything about that. Also, I have a question. You can put me on the list. Another type of question. Back to you, Roy. This is KD2NBB.
Okay, very good, Bob. Once again, this is AC2GS. When they initially set GMT, they kind of just set the baseline, and different towns could pretty much self-define what offset they wanted it to be. And some just, especially, you know, Americans, we like to be independent. We don't like to be forced or told to do anything. So there were a lot of towns that had different time zones. You would leave one town and go to another town. It would be a different time. It made train travel, which was becoming fundamental for this country and for Europe in general, very difficult and damn near headache-inducing. And so they passed a lot of laws to make it a lot saner. There are still some strange little places out there in the United States that do not have full integer offsets from UTC, but they're few and far between, whereas in Europe and Asia, it's not at all uncommon for them to be, you know, plus or minus, you know, one-half or three-quarters of a UTC unit.
Yeah. I didn't realize there were still places in the U.S. That's really interesting. And just to repeat, I do have another question. You know, put me on the list. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, Bob, you are definitely, absolutely, positively on the list. Getting back to David's question, I do not have a thorough exposition on Field Day. My understanding was it was started as one of the earlier events from the American Radio Relay League It was originally designed to act as a means of testing whether your equipment would be functional for emergency services, and that's why you can't have it, for the most part, in your shack. They want you to operate mobile outside of your, not in your location, in a movable location, in a tent or some non-fixed location, using some form of emergency, either battery-operated power. They keep saying that it is not a contest, although there is a point system, and there are rigorous rules of how you get points. So it's the biggest point-specific non-contest that I can think of. Let me drop for a sec. Now, usually, because of that, the ARRL is very obsessive-compulsive, and you can't just operate in your shack on field day most times. You can operate Class D, which is what that is. Class E is operating in your shack with an emergency power supply, but you can supposedly operate with utility power Class D in your shack, but only to communicate with other Class D people, and you don't really get points. In the case of this year, after much consideration, the ARRL changed their rules for this year and this year only, that you can operate under Class D in your house with utility power, and you can contact as many people as you want, and you can put out a contact, the list of your contacts, and list a club affiliation at the top of it, and when you submit it, they'll all be merged together, and the club will get those amount of points. So that's it in a gist.
QSL, thank you, Roy. Do you know anything about the logging software for field day?
WS2N comment first there, Roy.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, the 1D's, the standard system is the 1D's can contact anybody. I think you jumped over that too quick, Roy. They can contact anybody except for the one, for the 1D's. You know, if you're working with one station in your house, you're one Delta. So, you know, you could contact, you know, E's and F's and A's and B's and C's, just not D's. This year you could contact all of the above, plus the D's. It was the D's that, if you were operating last year and you came across a one Delta, you know, you would just be wasting your time. You can't send that one in for credit. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. I guess I did not make that clear. So they've kind of widened it for this year, and they've pretty much repeatedly said this is only a one-year thing. Don't expect it for next year, so, you know, we'll take what we can get. Getting back to David's other question, the most common login program that I'm aware of that a lot of people use for field day is it's named after its programmer, who's a ham. His call sign is November 3 Foxtrot Japan Papa, N3FJP. It's not a free piece of software. But sometimes if you have a club a subscription to it, you might be able to use it. I don't know if he set up anything in particular for this year. Also, some people use N1MM as a field day login software.
W2H,
right? Yes, Howard.
I had a question relating to time.
A2VCV.
Yeah, why don't we finish with David's question, and then I'll call on you, Howard, and we can discuss time. And I didn't quite make out the other person's call sign.
A2VCV with a comment on time. Go ahead.
Okay, so if it's about time, like I said, I think what we'll do is we'll finish up David, because David asked the question about the log for field day, and then we'll get back to you and Howard in relation to time. So So, David, does that answer your question? N3FJP is probably the preferred login software for Field Day, but some other people use N1MM login.
QSL, 100% copy. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. By the way, I just want to say hello to a bunch of people who are listening on IRLP. We have British Columbia, we have Ontario, Canada, we have California, and we have six people listening to the audio stream. So I want to say hello to all of them and welcome them aboard. Howard, W2HL, you wanted to say something about time.
Yeah, Roy, W2HL. Thank you. Good evening to everybody on the net. I just was, wondering what causes the Earth to spin, I guess all those planets too, on its axis. I assume it's gravity. And I think that because of I was wondering that they have to insert a couple of seconds into the time clock. I think every year or every couple of years. I think that's, or every 4 years, that's something to do with some imperfect, maybe, spin. I wonder if you could explain that. Thank you.
Okay, Howard. The reason that objects spin is because angular momentum is conserved for the most part, unless something else acts on it. And so you'll find that most things in our solar system are spinning in one direction or another. The jumping up and down is dampened over time due to other gravitational interactions. But spinning purely doesn't affect the gravity, so the angular momentum is conserved and we keep spinning. There is, though, drag from the moon and other factors, and so the rotation does slowly slow down. The Earth revolved much quicker, millions and millions of years ago. And because the revolution of the Earth is not precisely timed to seconds, that's why there are leap seconds, to adjust it to the astronomical constants. Otherwise, eventually, and the way things work with leap seconds, it would take an eternity, but you would have the same problem that you had with the Julian calendar, which is that January would be in the middle of the summer because of the seasons drifting out of alignment.
Okay. Why did the Earth spin faster years ago, like you said?
Because, angular momentum is conserved, but when you have something like a moon circling, there's an exchange of momentum between the moon and the Earth. And so the moon is being pushed farther away and picking up more spin, and that energy is coming from the angular momentum of the Earth. So it's basically sapping our momentum, if you will.
Why is there angular momentum on the Earth?
Well, simply because it was made out of constituent parts, and all particles have some degree of angular momentum. And so when you take a whole bunch of things with angular momentum and you squeeze them together, you get the sum of its components. They're almost never anything close to zero. And so most objects spin. The curious thing is, I believe it's Mercury spins the other way than all the other planets, and I think the theory behind it is that it got flung around and twisted upside down, and that's why it has a different angular momentum than most of the solar objects.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Appreciate that clear up. Back to you, W2HL.
Thank you, Howard, and thanks for participating tonight. JCV, JCV, I didn't get your prefix.
Very good, Dr. Roy. Thank you for letting me in. This is K2 Victor Charlie Victor, K2VCV, Gene and Selden. I was listening to everybody talk about the UTC, you know, time, all about UTC. I have a friend of mine. I used to grow, in fact, I grew up with this fellow. We took our test the same, about the same time, many, many years ago. He wrote a program for UTC that you could put on your PC. His call sign is K2VCO, like voltage controlled oscillator, K2VCO. His name is Vic. I think he's over in Israel now, but at any rate, you can look him up on QRZ and download this UTC program. It works excellent on all PCs, believe me. I've been using it, and it's very accurate, and it's tied into to the Internet, and it gives you the...
Okay, thank you very much, Gene. I assume that it's some kind of net server... client. NTP is a time client. There are time servers all over the world that are usually hooked into an atomic clock, and even Microsoft Windows regularly checks in with a time standard server and downloads a more accurate time. So I would assume that your friend K2VCO has some kind of NTP client that he's written.
I don't know exactly how what he did as far as his software, Dr. Roy, but it works beautiful. I mean, you can actually fine-tune it to seconds or whatever, and it does a very, very good job. And I've used that many, many times on a laptop and also on the regular desktop, but it's great. And you can put the clock anywhere on your desktop or whatever, and very, very accurate. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. It's good to hear. I went to his QRZ page. It doesn't have the software listed, but he has a personal website listed, so I'll look into that. There's a lot of clock utilities. Matter of fact, one of the earliest programs that I wrote for my Amiga, I wanted a kind of Swiss Army knife version of a piece of software, something that would do about 10 trillion different things. So I started off with a clock that it showed the time, and then I kept expanding it and expanding it to do all kinds of other little features, and I kept it around for a couple years. I updated it almost every week, and if anyone is familiar with Fred Fish was an amateur radio operator, but he was also into software distribution. He had the Fred Fish discs, and my software RSL clock was on there. So, fellow clock writer, I'll have to check him out.
Hey, very good, Dr. Roy. That's it for me. Thank you very much and for letting me in, and I hope you find that information. Just do a Google search on K2VCO and his UTC clock, and I'm sure it'll come up.
Okay, I will do that, Gene. Bob, KD2 NVB, you said you had a question for tonight.
NVB here. Had to dry my hands. I was washing dishes. Hold on, I'll drop for a sec. Yeah, Roy, this is Bob. Actually, it's kind of a COVID question. Just your opinion about a certain risk I might be taking. I'm a musician, and so this is relevant because I have an old piano with problems, and a friend of mine tipped me off to somebody. Actually, he's kind of sad because this studio, I think they teach kids piano and dance and stuff. They're going out of business probably because of this virus, and they're trying to load these pianos really cheap. So, like, some piano that's worth probably more than $2,000 is I can buy for $300, and then I have to pay to ship it. But... yeah, I'm a little worried about people coming into my apartment and taking out my piano and putting in this other piano. And, you know, I figure I could stand on the sidewalk the whole time, or I could stand, like it's a two-room apartment, I could stand on that far edge of the other room. I'd be 10 to 15 feet away from them the whole time. Then I'd have to do a lot of probably alcohol wiping after they leave. So I don't know if you have any opinions about how risky this is in our current viral situation. BB.
Well, I'm not going to tell you that there's zero risk. You know, when you get up in the morning and your feet hit the ground, you're already taking chances, very small chances, but chances. I think most studies so far would suggest strongly that the overwhelming majority of infections are occurring person to person. They're not really occurring via infected packages or touching something after someone's left the area. So, you know, either if you go to the far end of your house or go outside and wait a little while for gravity to do its thing and then just wipe it over, I think the risks are minimal.
Okay, Roy, thanks a lot. I think I bounced this off of you a couple weeks ago when I thought my refrigerator was going to die. It turned out that was a false alarm, and it was the same, almost the exact same situation. Yeah, I'll probably go for this thing. Maybe I'll walk around the block after. I trust them not to break things, taking the pianos out and in, because I won't be there to look at them. I'll just stay on the sidewalk, and when they're done, I'll walk around the block. That's another 5 to 10 minutes, and then I'll come back upstairs, something like that. Thanks, Roy. Back to you.
You're welcome, Bob. You know, I mean, like I said, life is a little risky, but I think as long as you treat it intelligently, I think you could keep the risk at a bare minimum, and it sounds like a reasonable thing to do. I mean, I see people out in the street 2 feet away from each other without masks gabbing to each other, and, you know, they're blissfully unconcerned. So, it's always good to be cautious, but, you know, you got to kind of hedge your bets and you got to look at the statistics. And there's not a lot of cases of people kind of going into a infected area with people gone for hours and hours and then becoming infected. It's usually the overwhelming majority so far that I've read about have been person-to-person infections. So wish you luck with that, Bob, and I hope you get a very, very nice new piano.
Thanks, Roy. Won't be new, but it'll be a lot newer than what I have now. Back to Ned. Thanks.
Well, it'll be new for you.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, very good. We're coming up to 10 o'clock, but before we give you the space report, as always, I give people the benefit. If they have any questions related to coronavirus, we've already talked a bit about it before, but if anyone has any particular questions that I might be able to help, I don't have all the answers. Some of the most brilliant research scientists don't have that many of the answers yet either. Science doesn't quite work that way. If you have an old science textbook, it makes it seem as though A went to B, went to C, went to D, went to E, and it was all very orderly and gentlemanly. That, unfortunately, is not really how science works. You take 2 steps forward, you take 1 step back, and you go back and forth. So there's still a lot left to be researched. There's a lot of fundamental primary type of research that hasn't been fully digested and fully understood. But keeping that in mind, and the fact that people have their own opinions about all kinds of things, if anyone has any questions related to the coronavirus, please, this is a good time as any to ask. Who says Witt is dead? Very well. Right before we go into the space report, I will give you one story. It is coronavirus related, but it was suggested by Paul. He found it an interesting subject. And so let me drop, and then I will give you this article that I've come up with. Okay, does everyone infected with the virus produce antibodies? And if so, how long do they last? Not very long ago, suggests a new study published this past Thursday in Nature Medicine. Antibodies, protective proteins made in response to an infection, may last only 2 or 3 months, especially in people who never showed symptoms while they were infected. The conclusions do not necessarily mean that these people can be infected a second time, several experts caution. Even low levels of powerful neutralizing antibodies may still be protective, as are the immune systems. Against the idea of immunity certificates for people who have recovered from illnesses, the authors suggest. Antibodies to other coronaviruses, including those that cause SARS and MERS, are thought to last about a year. Scientists had hoped that antibodies to the new virus might last at least as long as that. Let me drop for a sec. Several studies have shown that most people who are visibly ill with COVID-19 develop antibodies to the virus, although it has been unclear how long these antibodies last. The new study is the first to characterize the immune response in asymptomatic people. The researchers compared 37 asymptomatic people to an equal number who had symptoms in the Guangzhou district of China. The investigators found that asymptomatic people mount a weaker response to the virus than those who develop symptoms. Antibody levels fell to undetectable levels in 40% of asymptomatic people, compared with just 13% of symptomatic people. The sample size is small, however, and researchers did not take into account protection offered by immune cells that may fight the virus on their own or make antibodies when the virus invades. A few studies have shown that coronavirus stimulates a robust and protective cellular immune response. Most people are generally not aware of T-cell immunity, and so much of the conversation has focused on an antibody level, said Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University. Apart from T-cells, which can kill the virus on encounter, people who have been infected make so-called memory B-cells, which can rapidly ramp up antibody production when needed. Let me drop for a sec. If they find the virus again, they remember and start to make antibodies very, very quickly, said Florian Kramer, a virologist at the ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, who has led several studies of antibodies to the coronavirus. In a new study, antibodies to one viral protein dropped below detectable levels, but a second set of antibodies targeting the so-called spike protein of the coronavirus needed to neutralize the virus and prevent reinfection were still present. In fact, these antibodies seem to show a smaller decline in asymptomatic people than in symptomatic people. The neutralizing antibody is what matters, and that tells us a very different story, Dr. Kramer said. A second paper published this past Thursday in the journal Nature suggests that even low levels of antibodies might be enough to thwart the virus. It does appear that even low levels of certain antibodies have potent neutralizing capabilities, said Dr. Rasmussen, the Columbia University virologist. Low antibody titers don't necessarily determine whether a patient will be protected from reinfection. Between 20 and 50% of these infections may never show outward sign of illness. A new study from China, which tracks people over time to confirm that they never develop symptoms, put that number at 20%. About a third of the asymptomatic people had the ground glass opacities, characteristic of COVID-19, and abnormalities in the lungs and in cell types. However, let me drop for a sec. The study also found that asymptomatic people shed virus when infected and did so far longer than those who had symptoms. This finding is interesting because it actually might suggest that these asymptomatic patients are indeed capable of transmitting the virus, Dr. Rasmussen said. But she and other experts noted that it's unclear whether the virus shed by asymptomatic people are capable of infecting others. It is important to know if they are shedding infectious virus or just remnants of the virus, said Akiko Awasaki, a viral immunologist at Yale University. These reports suggest the need to develop strong vaccines because immunity that develops naturally during infection is suboptimal and short-lived in most people. We may not be able to rely on natural infection to achieve herd immunity. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Thank you.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Yeah, what do you think of his relationship with blood type and how your blood type might affect the severity if you do contact or contract the disease? I know nothing.